Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and on the line, calling in from Southern California, writer and director of Mush the Movie, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. How are you today?
Pretty good, thank you.
It was a very exciting start out in Willow, a little bit warm, as we discussed yesterday, but it looks like a lot of the teams are doing very, very well, and I'm very excited that Iditarod 41 is finally officially underway.
It is, and you know, Alex, I woke up this morning with one heck of a head cold and didn't even venture over to the lake. I just kind of stayed back and let things take care of itself, so I am ready to go here. As they say, the show must go on. What is new to report?
Well, you know, we had an interesting and unusual thing happen yesterday, which is that a musher scratched at Campbell Airstrip. So a musher scratched at the end of the unofficial start, the ceremonial start in Anchorage, which doesn't even really count. Usually, it's not unusual for there to be a couple of scratches early in the race, sometimes the first day, but this is the first time I can remember a musher basically scratching before the race began, but actually participating in the ceremonial start. And that musher is Ed Stelstra.
Stelstra.
I'm sure I've totally mispronounced his name. And that's kind of an interesting story because he apparently, during a training run about 3 weeks ago, had a very bad fall and was dragged a little bit and then hit his head and required 19 stitches and just wasn't feeling confident and wasn't feeling like his recovery had progressed enough that he felt comfortable taking his team out onto the trail. But on the other hand, he didn't want to let down his Iditarider. Apparently he's had the same Iditarider for the past 8 years, and he felt that he owed it to his sponsors to at least come up to Alaska and do the ceremonial start. So he did that yesterday.
That is big news, right. Alex. I didn't hear that at all. Of course, I've been a little bit under the weather, but that is huge news. I don't think in all the years that I've covered and become a fan of the Iditarod, I've ever heard of anything like that. That's big news.
Yeah, and there's a Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News, I believe, has a video that he tweeted where he interviews Ed, and I believe Ed actually showed him his scar, which is on the top of his head and just looks horrible. So it's a very unusual thing. Obviously, first of all, we want him to get better and be healed up well enough so that he can come back and race next year. But also, this is something that I think shows a great deal of respect for the race and respect for knowing your own limitations and not wanting to do anything that would put the dogs at risk.
That's exactly right. And, you know, he just arrived in Alaska just the other day. I follow him on Facebook, and he's pretty active there. He just arrived into Alaska either Sunday or Monday of this week. He drove all the way up here from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, so that was a several-day long drive. And then he arrives up here and does a ceremonial start and scratches. That's pretty big news, Alex. Yeah, I hope everything is okay. And like you said, injuries are often pretty gnarly when they occur, especially when you get tangled up in a snow hook. And I believe that's what happened. And I know from firsthand experience, those things can kill you relatively quickly if you don't watch out.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it is Lance Mackey and many other of the top mushers always say that if it if they are not certain that they can take care of themselves and their dogs, they will withdraw or scratch immediately. It's not even a question, because you're out there, and as we discussed yesterday, on the trail for weeks at a time, getting very, very little sleep, and you really need to have your wits about you and just to be able to take care of yourself and the dogs.
That's exactly right. As we mentioned yesterday, you'll often go till Tuesday or Wednesday of this week without any sleep. I know the Mushin mortician, Scott Jansen, said yesterday on Facebook that he will not get any rest until Wednesday afternoon when he arrives in Talkeetna. So that is a pretty arduous task, going from Saturday or Sunday till Tuesday or Wednesday without any sleep at all.
Right, especially since, as we discussed, the first part of the trail is pretty gnarly compared to, I mean, there's no part of the trail that I think is really simple or easy, but there's a lot of elevation gain. There's the gorge, there's the steps. So that part of the race, that early part of the race, the first third or so, can really take its toll on mushers, especially if they're not feeling 100% well physically.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, Alex, often every year several mushers will scratch in those first checkpoints, Yetna, Squintna, Finger Lake, and, of course, Rainy Pass is right after there. That is a tough trail. Once you get past Squintna, it does go uphill relatively quickly, and then right there past Finger Lake and into Rainy Pass is where those notorious steps are that have claimed many a musher, including lots of veterans as well.
Yes, and regularly photographers and the Iditarod Insider people will kind of camp out there, because mushers will come around some of those curves going very, very fast, sometimes barely in control of their teams, and really riding the break and trying desperately not to fall off the sled and to maintain some semblance of control.
That's exactly right, and often right there in that area, whether it's going into the steps or a little bit later on in the Dazelle Gorge, often many of mushers will have their sleds just disintegrate, whether hitting trees or boulders or whatever, and often they'll have to scratch right then because they don't have access to another sled until McGrath, Talkeetna, wherever they're taking their 24.
Exactly, yeah. So officially, I was just looking at the standing board on Iditarod.com, and it doesn't look like they're showing anyone actually in Squintna yet. But looking at the GPS, there are several racers who look like they are either in or very close to being in, and it's probably the people you would expect. A lot of the racers who came out early, Martin Boozer, Scott Jansen, Paul Gebhardt, Jody Bailey, Lance Mackey, and it looks like they are either already in Squintna or they will be within 10 or 15 minutes.
And I've been on that run a few times from the community center up to that area, and it's a relatively easy part of the trail from Willow to Squintna through Yetna. Often Yetna is just a flyby checkpoint. Most of them do not stop there. They don't have any gear or food or anything like that for the dogs. They just sign in and out on their way to Squintna, where many mushers will often stop at least to give a small meal to the dogs before heading on into the more difficult part of the race.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to really get a clue as to what people's run and rest strategy is over the next 12 to 24 hours.
Right, exactly. So, Alex, besides the news with Ed, which obviously I do appreciate that, I haven't heard that myself, I'm sure everybody that's listening thinking, where are you at, in a cave over here? So I do appreciate that, but any other news or sound bites or anything else that you heard at the restart on the Insider that is worth sharing today?
It was pretty much, there was nothing very surprising. Most of the mushers were getting their last minute hugs and kisses from their family before they ran out, before they started. there were a lot of people in Willow. There usually are a lot of people in Willow, but it was a very, very nice crowd there, which I'm always glad to see. I just wanted to mention for people who don't know, unlike yesterday, the Willow start isn't until 2 p.m., and so the mushers will start arriving. Some of them like to get there early, but generally they'll get there by 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning and lay out all of their gear. There are last-minute checks by the vets. All of the dogs are scanned to make sure that they are properly microchipped and it's the right dog going out. There are drug tests. Urine is collected from the dogs for drug testing. And it's the last chance for the media to interview or talk to the mushers. And then I believe it's at noon, the area, the sort of backstage area where the mushers gather is swept clean of all of the media. And so the mushers have an hour or two to do their last-minute preparations in relative peace with just their handlers and the official Iditarod volunteers, but away from any of the press and away from people constantly asking them questions.
And just like the ceremonial start, it's near pandemonium there with all that press and all of that interaction with the media. One thing that is key compared to the ceremonial start in Anchorage, there is no fan contact necessarily. Everybody's behind a fence at the restart, whereas at the ceremonial start, often you'll have fans coming up and talking with and getting hugs with the mushers and all that sort of stuff. That does not occur at the restart. It's down to business. It's about time to race at that point.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, just as in Anchorage, once you cross Willow Lake, there's a lot of people along both sides of the trail for that first couple of miles. Once you get over that first lake, there are still people there, but they start to be a lot more spread out. And in those other lakes, right past Willow Lake, Long Lake, and I forget what the name of the third one is, there usually are people having parties, having block parties, having barbecues. And because they're a little bit more spread out, the mushers can really interact with them. They cheer for all of the mushers going by, but they have conversations with the mushers. At times they'll as they do in the Anchorage Woods, they'll give them hot dogs or they'll give them, you know, water or sodas or what have you. And a lot of people who are along the sides will sort of get close to the musher and stick their hands out so they can high-five the mushers. And then the further away you get from the start, the fewer and fewer people there are. So by the time the mushers are 5 or 10 miles out, they're more or less on their own.
That's exactly right. As they hit those lakes, it's about 12 miles to the Big Sioux River from the start, and you kind of crisscross over several lakes as you're running down to the river, and then you'll take a sharp left turn down a hill called Correll Hill. It's a pretty steep decline. I've been down that way many a times, and if you aren't prepared, you can crash right there within 12 miles of the race, and then you hit that river, and it's literally an interstate to Yentna, and then as you hit Yentna, you hit the Squintner River, and then you make a hard right on up to Squintner, the Squintner Roadhouse, and then you pass over some swamps and some bogs and whatnot before you head into the hills on your way to Finger Lake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because obviously there is opportunity for people to pass each other, and the faster teams start pulling in front of some of the slower teams. Given all of that, it does seem like a lot of the teams are pretty much in the order that they left. There are a few that have lagged behind a little bit and a few that have jumped forward, but at least at this point, the teams are pretty much together.
Right, and you don't want to go full bore out of the starting line and on your way to Yentna and Squintna. You don't want to burn your dogs out in the first 50 or 60 miles. So often they'll take it very slow onto those first couple of checkpoints.
Right, and that's where when you're one of the teams that's really in contention, one of the teams that you would expect to have a top 15 or top 20 or a top 10 finish, that's when they really start working out and developing their strategy, and they don't want to necessarily be the rabbits who run forward and go ahead of the pack but then lose steam halfway through the race. And you want to make sure also that you're not too far behind so that you don't have too much ground that you'll have to make up much later in the race, which also can be very, very difficult.
That is true. So, Alex, we got about half of the show left. We typically start our musher profile at this point. We've already talked about Ed and his scratch, but who are we talking about today?
Well, today I wanted to talk a little bit about your Lisseth Olsom, who is the young Norwegian musher. He is someone that a lot of people who are careful watchers of the race are predicting can be the rookie of the year this year. He's a very, very strong and accomplished musher, although this is his first Iditarod. It's an odd and interesting story. He and Mikhail Telpin, who's the Russian musher, are together in this venture that's called Racing Beringia. And Beringia refers to this area that goes from eastern Russia to the Yukon territory in Canada. And 10 or 20,000 years ago, when the Bering Land Bridge was still in place, that was all connected. And it's believed that that is where modern dog mushing began, and the idea of using dogs as a means of transportation and as a means of moving cargo really began in that area. And there's a third person involved in this, and that's a Danish woman named Millie Porsild. And she is a teacher and an amateur dog musher, and she was running some dogs in the Chukotka region of eastern Russia, and she ran into Mikhail Telpin, and he decided that he didn't believe that it was safe for her to be running dogs alone, so he ran his dogs with her. They started talking, and she had this idea of forming this educational online website and presence where they would gather educational material about this area. And then they recruited Jor Olsom, who was a farmer in Norway, had started running a bunch of different races, and they recruited him to help them in this endeavor. And what they are doing is running these three long-distance races. So it's the Yukon Quest, the Iditarod, and a Russian race called the Nadezhda Hope Race. And together, these three races are over 3,000 miles. Olsom just turned 26. He's really considered an up-and-comer in Scandinavian racing. He's not part of the formal Team Norway that Robert Sorley led about 10 years ago, Sorley, who won the race twice. And I just saw online today that he's planning on coming back to Iditarod in 2014. So he's not part of that team, but he's very much in that tradition of Sorley's approach to training and working with the dogs. Olsom runs a team of dogs that are very, very similar to Alaskan Huskies, and most of them come from Alaskan Husky lines. That's different from Mikhail Telpin, who runs what they call Chukotka dogs, which are a little bit smaller, and they're a little bit more squat, and they were bred for hauling large amounts of weight rather than for either distance running or for speed. But Olsom is running the Alaskan Huskies. He ran the Yukon Quest last year, and he came in sixth. He ran earlier the Nadezhda Hope race and was the first non-native to win the race in more than 20 years, and he set a course record. That's a very strange race because the exact course and the length of the race vary from year to year. So at times it's been as little as 170 miles, and some years it's been over 1,200 miles. Alston also has run a lot of sprint races, and he's run all of the major Scandinavian dog races. And so he is definitely somebody to watch, and I think that he is a good, there's a good chance he could definitely have a top 20 finish if things go well for him.
You know, Alex, you had mentioned Mikhail Tilpin and his dogs, and we were standing there at the starting line yesterday at the ceremonial start, and his dogs look quite a bit different than just about every other dog team that's in the race. Very furry, almost bear-like or Akita-like looking dogs, very interesting looking dogs compared to the sleek and often slender Alaskan Huskies. They were definitely a sight to be seen compared to most of the teams, and I was very impressed with what he had put forth, at least at the ceremonial start. So I'm just interested to see how both of these guys work their way through the race.
Yeah, they are very, very different racers in terms of temperament, in terms of strategy. Tilpin, I believe, ran the Yukon Quest this year and had a lot of problems. Apparently, he had never run anywhere where there are trees before. So he wasn't quite sure what the strategy should be with regard to running through the woods. And his dogs were uneasy about running so close to trees. Hopefully now that he's run the quest, they'll be a little bit more used to it going down the Iditarod Trail. But he will be a very interesting racer to watch as well. He's also, I've seen a few interviews with him. He speaks very, very little English, and at least at the start and when he was in Anchorage, he had an interpreter with him. So every time he was interviewed, all of the questions would go through the interpreter, and then there would be, you know, a few hand signals and gestures like that.
You know, you had mentioned that the dogs were a little spooked by the trees. When he was on the ceremonial start, right as he left the starting chute, his dogs got spooked a little bit and ran off the road towards the parking garage. I don't know if they saw another dog or something that spooked them, but that plays into training your sled dogs. Your sled dogs should definitely be accustomed to all of those things. I know he lives in Russia where there's very little people, very little obstacles that he comes across in his mushing training, but that's something that we work on all the time here with our teams, is to get him used to the dog trucks and the, you know, dropping and changing them around and getting used to people and noises and loud things like, hollering and sirens and that sort of thing. Here at our kennel, we start training our puppies when they are very young. We take them in rides into dog trucks and that sort of thing, just to get them accustomed to being around things that they'll see at a race. And I think that's an important part of this, because when a lot of these mushers go into the checkpoints, it's still craziness. There's a lot of vets, a lot of people, a lot of checkers. You know, they have to be used to that, or they just won't settle down and they won't get the rest that they need.
Absolutely, and I think it's important to remember that dogs are pack animals, and dogs are very susceptible to the excitement that can spread when there are a lot of dogs around, or when they sense that they're about to go out for a run, because these dogs just absolutely adore running. They live for running, and you can see if you're in a dog yard and there are dogs who are hitched up and taken out for a run, the other dogs who are left behind just don't quite understand why they don't get to go as well.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And we have one dog that's in our C team in terms of our you know, the distances or the teams that are set up. His name is Harvey, and he gets very excited like that. And he'll often sit on top of his house looking out towards the trail that we leave on. He'll sit there the entire time, wait until we get back, because he just doesn't quite understand how come he doesn't get to go on the big boy team, you know, get to run with the racers. He often has to run with the puppies and the younger dogs. He's just not experienced enough to run with the big boys yet.
Exactly. And even dogs that are coming from relatively large kennels, kennels where there are, you know, 100 dogs or more, they still are not used to the absolute chaos that you have at the start of at either the ceremonial start or the restart in Willow, when you will literally have 1,000 dogs in a very, very small place. And you have to be very aware of making sure that your dogs know when it is and is not their turn to go, because the last thing you want is to have a dog or several dogs who all of a sudden decide that they're just going. And, you know, that's why dogs are when dogs are taken out of trucks, they are put on lines and not allowed to run free in the staging area.
You know, that's a great point, because when the teams are coming into the checkpoints, and as we're talking about socializing and working with these dogs, the teams will often, quote-unquote, camp very close to each other, sometimes 6, 7, 8 feet away, and often the teams around you will leave at different times. And let's say that you're doing a four-hour layover at a checkpoint. Just because somebody's sitting beside you and they get ready to leave, the dogs don't understand that. When that team leaves, they want to leave too, and they still might have a 2 or 3 hour rest, and they have to get that much-needed rest. They can't be on guard all the time, thinking that, wow, the team's going, you know, beside me is going to take off. I better get ready and jump up and take off too, because your dogs will never get any rest. And that's key to the sport of mushing is an established checkpoint routine, not only for the musher but the dogs as well.
Absolutely. And a lot of that is dependent on the bond that the musher will have with the dogs and the relationship that the mushers will have with the dogs. You see a lot of the top mushers spending a lot of time with their individual dogs and making sure that they talk to their dogs and that they really let the dogs know what's going on. And I'm not going to tell you that dogs can speak English perfectly, but there definitely is an amazing level of communication between mushers and dogs, especially, you know, some of the top mushers. Lance Mackey is legendary for his ability to communicate with and really, you know, a lot of people think that Lance basically thinks that he's a dog, or maybe the dogs think that they're Lance. But in any case, his communication level with his dogs is just almost legendary.
That's exactly right. Alex, we have about a minute and a half to go. What do you want to talk about tomorrow? And now we're in the race, all the preliminary stuff's done, the banquets are done, the training runs are done, it's race time. As you mentioned, several of the mushers are making their way towards Squintna. What's on tap for tomorrow evening?
Well, you know, I thought tomorrow we could talk a little bit about Cindy Abbott and maybe go over some basic strategies for the early part of the race.
That sounds wonderful, and as we mentioned, that you do have a soundbite from your interview, and if we get that loaded up for tomorrow, we'll definitely play that. As we mentioned, the strategies are going to start coming into play within hours here. The last musher went out about 2 hours ago. Number 66, Bruce Linton, has been on the trail for about 2 hours, where the first musher, Martin Booser, has been on the trail for about 4.5 hours. So the race has started. And for the next 9-10 days or so, you'll hear us every night here on Mushing Radio, and we'll make sure that we post any information that we hear throughout the day and in and into the evening. Alex, it was a pleasure.
Thanks, Robert. And everyone should like us on Facebook if you haven't already done that.
There you go, Dogworks Radio and Mushing Radio, and I'll make sure we put links to our Twitter feeds as well. This is Robert Forto on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.